Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Welcome to our podcast,
Life After the Letters.
I'm Amelie.
And I'm Suba.
We're friends that met whilst working our first shifts as junior doctors.
And we're here to talk about the stories and challenges that we face every day. Hey, Amelie.
Hey, Suba.
What it do?
I literally see this girl too much.
For
the past 2 years since I've known her, I've seen her pretty much probably most days of the year.
Yeah, actually, because also we did like a job together, basically our surgical job together.
Oh yeah, we did.
Yeah, and then we went to
the next. We had the best jobs on that surgical placement. Yeah, do you remember?
It was so great.
Suba was on breast surgery and I was on vascular surgery.
We basically, between us, had like a sum of about
20 patients?
Mate, I was going to say 10. Yeah. I usually had about 2 patients a day and you had about 5.
Yeah. And I reckon we were probably the most annoying people in the hospital at that time because we would be like, okay, guys, how can we help you with your patients? Should we do that job for you?
And literally after we've done pretty much every job you could imagine under the sun for our patients, updated the list, like tidied everything, like, do you know what I mean?
Made tea and coffee for the patients.
Our patients loved us though.
Yeah, that's what happens when you've got enough time.
Yeah, when you've got like nothing else
exactly.
to do.
Exactly. And unlimited resources, it feels like, when you've got no patients. So that was great.
Yeah, good times. But today, on the topic of patients, we're talking about internet, the age of the internet in patients' hands, which has really changed like the way in which patients approach medicine, health issues, and how they come to you as their doctor as well. It's
changed. Because things have changed for us compared to our seniors. So our seniors weren't around in the age of the internet, because actually when we were growing up, maybe when we were in primary school, that's when we were searching internet more than our parents were.
And remember like the modems and the like
mate, can you remember waiting to use the phone before?
Oh my God, I remember
someone else could go on the internet.
When my mum would answer the phone whilst I was like playing, you know, those bubblegum games. And I would be like, mum, I was on level 10.
Do you know what the stress was? Trying to download those like illegal tracks.
LimeWire.
It's actually so bad. It's so bad.
Can I get us done? I hope not.
But I remember you'd be downloading a track and you're like, okay, I've been waiting 15 minutes to download a 3-minute track. And then
99.5%.
Mum's calling someone from Nigeria. Also shouting at the same time. And I'm like, mum, they can hear you exactly the same.
Yeah. No, but I feel like, is your parent ethnic if they don't hold the phone right up to their ear and still scream down the phone?
Yeah.
It's not how it works, mum. It's
not at all. Not at all. But this is like the week of ARCP for most people. So I thought we have to touch on it.
No,
so for those of you who don't know, or most of people probably do know.
You know, you know.
But ARCP is a time when you're coming towards the end of your foundation years.
Yeah.
Actually, for every single year.
Yeah.
And you have to accumulate all the information from the past year and get people to sign you off on clinical skills that you've done, good patient interactions or negative patient interactions, reflections, just so you can get signed off for the year and then progress into your next year of being a doctor.
Yeah, basically so, a portfolio of your evidence that shows that you're competent to progress. I don't actually know what the letters ARCP stand for. Do you?
I don't.
I
feel like P stands for progress and R stands for recommendation. But I'm not sure whether I just pulled that out of thin air, mate. We're actually just, it's terrible because this is what we do every year.
Yeah, this is literally like the focus of our year and we haven't got a clue. But anyways, I'm so relieved to have like wrapped every little bit up. You know, all the little annoying.
Have you? Okay.
Have you not?
Super, you know me by now.
Yeah, yeah, I do. So, Amelie's a last minute gal.
I'm so last minute, but I'm also, this is what's weird. I'm like organized at the same time of being super ditzy, klutzy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. She's a weird clumsy. Juxtaposition. This chick has like 20 notebooks for like writing down all her 20 agendas, but then she doesn't know where she's written her like agendas.
Understand? Or what time I have meetings for, or yeah. dates. It's actually terrible. It actually also made me resit a year of med school, but
That's a great story.
That's another story. And that was my shookest moment as a medical student.
I'm not surprised, mate. That would have been my shookest moment.
Should I just say it?
Yeah, go on, tell us.
So basically...
When you told me the story, I remember I was literally like... so my heart was just like so sad for you. I felt like I was there experiencing it with you. Anyways, tell us.
So basically, in my second year of med school, I had to resit an exam. And I also had to resit the exam because I was so cocky because like through GCSE, A-level, first year of med school, I didn't like really revise and I also used to pass quite well.
Those were good days.
Anywho, turns out you do need knowledge for being a doctor. So I went to my exam, resit, had a look at the times and I was like, okay, cool. I'm going to go chill in the library because I've got about 5 hours to the exam until the exam starts. And that was during the summertime because that's when you'd have to resit. Rock up to the exam and then I see everyone sitting there and I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Those must be the people for the first semester exam. And then I'm like looking around and I'm like, oh my God, why do I know all these people in the room? And then I'm standing outside and then one of the examiners comes out and is like, excuse me, there is an exam taking place. Can you leave? And then I was like, And then lo and behold, that's my exam in there. My exam is literally taking place. And it turns out that I read the times of the exam wrong. I still think it's their fault for writing it in the format in which they wrote it. There was some dashes, hyphens, a weird spacing. No,
it sounds confusing.
It was actually very confusing. And my supervisors understood at the time why I'd mistaken the exam. But right then in that moment, I was like, look, I've revised so hard. I can do this exam in half an hour. And he's like, no, it's a 3-hour exam. I was like, you don't understand how hard I've revised. Like,
let me in
the paper. And I was like, you don't understand my parents. My doctor dad is going to kill me. So yeah, actually, weirdly, my parents took it fine because they know who I am and they know that like my mind works so bizarrely. So yeah, long story short, I had to come back the next year.
To do the whole year again?
No, I had to do the semester for the exam. So I took a year out. Well, took half a year out, worked in Apple, which was like the most fun time of my life. Yeah. And it was so dope working for like a nice company.
Yeah. And a creative like company.
Yeah, exactly. And I met really cool people. So I was working in the Covent Garden store for about 6 months. Nice. And then I was like, yeah, back to med school for that thing that happened last summer. But back to ARCP. So ARCP will be finished next week, hopefully, and get signed off.
And once that's done, it's like, it feels kind of like, you know, when you finish your exams, but then you go back to school for like a few weeks and you just kind of watch movies and stuff. Not that that's what we're going to be doing at work. Yeah. I wish they set up a projector in recess and we can just lay on some sofas. But no, it's going to be like being back at work, but actually you're signed off, you're good to go. And it's just kind of like,
it's quite nice. It's quite an exciting chapter, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And everyone's, and because we're coming up to the end of F2, it's like all of our friends and colleagues are going off and doing Such different things. Which is so exciting. We've got friends and colleagues that are going on, like, that are actually taking breaks from medicine and going into other fields.
Friends. Some people are leaving, full stop.
Yeah. We've got people that are going
abroad. Shout out Pete, because I was going to
say, I'm literally seeing Pete's face in my mind as I say that.
I'm seeing his face, like, with lots of money just, like, dropping down on him from, like, the financial district.
Okay, now I was imagining him in, like a rap music video with, like, fur coats and, like, big old chains.
Pete's working. No, it's funny. But
Pete's going to be listening to this.
Some really exciting news about where she's going next year.
Yeah, I can't believe I've not mentioned this yet, but I'm going to New Zealand in August. I'm moving to Auckland, so catch me out there, guys.
Which makes it awkward for this podcast because Super does not know, but I'm looking for a new podcast host.
Are you acting like I don't know? Am I dizzy? Like, I know.
I'm joking. So what's your plan for New Zealand?
Yeah, so I'm working in obs and gynae, so I'm starting doing a 3-month job in that because I'm trying to make my mind up and if I love it, then I'll carry on. If not, mm-hmm. I might rotate through other things.
Okay, so you can choose your rotations as you go along?
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of, they're quite flexible. And then...
what other options do you have in mind?
I think we've spoken about this, but I'm thinking also about palliative care. So maybe a palliative care job, but I'm doing a taste a week in a few weeks. So I'm sure I'll be telling you guys about
that
anyways.
You're doing a taste a week where?
At our hospital.
In London?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. And I'm doing like 3-4 days on palliative care. So I'm going to go to like hospice, do some clinics, do a ward round.
Oh, you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And I think if I don't know, we'll see. Like, if I really like it, then I'll try and do a palliative care job out in Auckland. Mm-hmm. So those two things are there.
Cool. Yeah, I feel like it's something, once you've done palliative care, you'll either know.
Yeah.
Or you'll be like, this is exactly.
I think it's going to be one way or the other way.
Yeah,
and
totally.
Irrespective, it's such a great thing to do and to learn. There's so many things you can learn from it. So.
Yeah, it is. Like, I think that's one of my biggest take-homes from this year. After working my elderly care job, which I'm on currently, I think I've learned so much about palliative care and end-of-life medicine.
Yeah.
And how it's not actually very scary at all. It's just really important to have. And I wish we all had a bit more of an appreciation for it.
Yeah, it's so important for us to all have an understanding of it, because we all will come into contact with, in any field, like, you will come into contact with that, and it's good for you to have, like, an appreciation for how best...
to manage families who are going through it for the first time.
Exactly, and how to support people. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to New Zealand. And what about you, Amelie? What's your plans for next year? Come on, tell us.
Literally, my mind is in like 100 places at once. So,
as per usual.
So I've applied for absolutely everything.
Yeah.
Initially, I was starting to apply for the New Zealand thing as well, because I was like, oh, maybe we should just go together.
Yeah, it could be like life after the... Pacific Ocean. I don't know. I know I was going with that one.
So yeah, I've applied for a lot of things, and so different jobs, mm-hmm. mainly to make money. So I want a locum next year. So I want to make like a good amount of money. So I'm trying to look at jobs that are paying like more than your London rate. So London rates are usually about what, £35 an hour?
Locum rates, yeah, locum they're capped, rates. Yeah.
And then outside of London, it's more so £50 an hour, which is like...
I feel like the limit is endless outside of London.
It kind of is.
Yeah.
So it's just to make money for a year, because I don't really see any other way of like affording a house in London or a mortgage in London.
And that's like a big priority for you at the moment,
yeah,
isn't
I think
it?
So, just because it's something that I've always wanted outside of uni.
Yeah.
But when I left uni, houses cost, what, about 200,000 in London, or a two-bed apartment could. And now there is no way that I can get a house for that much.
It's mad,
so
yeah.
I just know that I've got to, if that's still my priority, that I've got to like try and make money for the next year.
Yeah.
So that's a plan. But I've also seen some jobs with, like, you know, companies like KPMG, where they want doctors to come and do a taste a week and see how you find it. So I thought, let me just try things.
Yeah.
As young, as cute, just try everything.
I didn't know this. So what's the KPMG thing?
Literally, I have no idea. Like, I read it and I've started my application for it. But essentially, it's a weekend consultancy for doctors.
Okay.
So it's for doctors who have tried entrepreneurial things outside of medicine or during like their training, med school and work.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, I think that's
Yeah, that
me.
Sounds like you, yeah.
So there's lots of different things that I think I can contribute. And I think it'll be nice to learn from a new environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And pick up like a new skill set.
Yeah, exactly. And then, yeah, we'll see where next year or 2 years takes me. And then maybe pediatrics one day.
One day in the distance.
One day in the future.
So should we go and talk about what we came to talk about today?
Yes, let's. So this all kind of, you know, we got talking about this after I was chatting to Amelie about a case that I saw in A&E.
A&E brings up the best cases, don't they?
Genuinely.
Yeah, because it brings such a variety of people into your field of vision, doesn't it?
Exactly. And like people that, and experiences that you only have in A&E, because you wouldn't have that on a ward or whatever else.
Yeah. And I love how we talk about our echo chambers, but by talking about the community of people that you naturally have around you, don't you?
Yeah.
So actually, I think the case that you're talking about isn't a natural community for you where you'll be hearing these cases, because actually we're invited into the intimate lives of patients.
Yeah.
So yeah, do you want to go?
Yeah. So I had a young, cute, popping little boy come in to A&E in a really bad state. So he was really stressed, really worried, and he was concerned that he may have contracted HIV. And before coming into A&E, actually, he had gone elsewhere trying to sort of seek advice and possibly seek post-exposure prophylaxis.
Do you know where he went?
It was like a walk-in clinic or something along those lines. And actually the healthcare professional who had treated him there had actually informed him, and incorrectly so, that he wouldn't be able to access PEP. And for those of you guys who don't know what PEP is, I'm sure you all on the, you do, but anyways, it's post-exposure prophylaxis. So it's, it actually encompasses the treatment of HIV, Hep B and Hep C. Yeah. And it's, sort of boosters or tablets or, you know, medication that you can give someone after they have possibly come into contact with bloodborne viruses such as HIV, Hep B, Hep C. So she had mistakenly informed him that he could not have anything anywhere he went. So he then used the magic of the interwebs to Google things, search it up, and then turned up, at our doorstep, sort of with his concerns. And appropriately so, because that's, it's the right thing to do. And I was like really impressed at the fact that how much in that scenario, like the patient advocated for himself, used the resources available to him to access his health needs, And I thought that was, great. Because if that was 10 years ago or like 20 years ago, you kind of would have turned up to whoever you turned up to. And if they had told you like, you can't have this, he would have like
gone home. Do you know what option she gave him at the time?
I think that whoever risk assessed him basically turned around to him and said, irrespective, you just can't access PEP, which is incorrect, Yeah. Because even for healthcare professionals, like if we get needle sticks, and that's out of hours, even if you're in the community, you present yourself to A&E to have, to be risk assessed and to have, your PEP, like whatever you need.
So now that you've said that, that's just reminded me of my friend who was working as a doctor in A&E, and she had a needle stick injury, and she knew that it was from a patient who had HIV.
Okay.
And she was out of hours at the time. And usually what would happen if you're working within normal hours, so Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, you would just go straight away to your occupational therapy department, have your blood tests done, and then be treated as such. So the problem with this case was at that time she went to go speak to a consultant. Her consultant told her to come back in on Monday morning and have her blood test then because of the occupational therapy. Occupational health could come and help.
Yeah. Here we're thinking of like Zimmer frames.
And stair lifts.
Yeah.
No, so he told us to come to occupational health on Monday morning.
Yeah.
And at that time she was like, okay, I'm sure I heard something back in med school about actually, no, you can... There's a 48-hour window where actually you can come and get your bloods taken, because actually if you do contract HIV, then the best thing to do is start straight away on PEP. And then that could prevent you from actually seroconverting into full-blown HIV. Yeah. I hate the fact that I just said full-blown, by the way, sorry. But that's what people are thinking, essentially. And that's what I just wanted to...
Yeah.
And that's also...
You sped that up real quick.
sorry. But then she just quickly did a Google search and then she found out that actually, she has to get it sorted sooner rather than later. Precisely. So she got it sorted later that evening, and thankfully she didn't contract anything, but it was just important that she did it within a short frame time.
And also that kind of doubles onto the fact that everyone's knowledge and information, it isn't infallible. Like we make mistakes. We all have gaps in our knowledge. And the beauty of her, say, for instance, being able to just quickly search it up and be like, oh, actually, no, is that she can protect and advocate for herself when someone else may not necessarily have the right tools to be able to do so. Yeah.
And it's important to recognise that healthcare professionals don't know everything.
So it's my story. I was talking to Emily about it and I was just like, I just thought it was great. And we were talking about how internet in patients' hands can be wonderful, but it's not always a perfect thing either. So talking of how the internet has actually shaped healthcare for a huge cohort of people, I wanted to talk about, and we talked about PEP, but let's talk about PrEP. So PrEP is pre-exposure prophylaxis. Mm-hmm. And that actually is, whilst PEP applies to sort of HIV, Hep B and Hep C, PrEP is a lot more specific to HIV. Mm-hmm. So, and I mean, there is an aspect of PrEP with things like Hep B, but that's sort of immunizations and things like that for Hep B and Hep C. But for PrEP, you've got your magic pill, Truvada.
Yeah.
And I'm sure people have all heard of it, but just to quickly recap on it, it's a pill you can take, which for people that are high risk for exposure to HIV, and it reduces, it's very effective at reducing your chances of seroconverting or of catching HIV. Mm-hmm. And it's completely revolutionized, like, certain communities, and particularly speaking about the gay community, mm-hmm. where transparency about HIV infection is really important, to the point yeah. where people will display that on, like, their dating profiles. Mm-hmm. And even if they are, say, HIV positive, people will also display if they're taking antiretrovirals,
yeah.
how long they've been taking antiretrovirals for. People are really transparent about their viral loads, their CD4 counts. Mm-hmm. And even with PrEP, people are very transparent about saying, I'm taking PrEP. And it's encouraged. And actually, it allows, like, in our latest episode, we were talking about allowing women to have autonomy and control over their yeah. bodies. And in a way, like, something like having PrEP allows gay men to have...
the same conversations and the same safety awareness as
exactly,
well.
Exactly, because that's mm-hmm. what's important at the end of the day, isn't it? It is about yeah. allowing people to have safe practices. Mm-hmm. And if people can have access to something like Truvada,
yeah.
then they can have safer sexual practices and feel more confident and reassured when they're engaging in certain activities that they are protected.
And what's interesting is that the internet brings that information straight towards your door.
Yeah.
As opposed to you having to, like, live, say, in Soho and near Dean Street, where you can access the clinic straight away.
Exactly.
So for those of us who aren't lucky to live near the locations which best serve us, actually the internet brings that straight to you. So that's amazing for
it's
patients
incredible.
In so many different communities and so yeah. many different areas.
It reduces that sort of disparity of, like, health provision. Mm-hmm. And the amazing thing is that there was this guy who contracted HIV and, you know, sort of grew up in that time where a lot of his friends and, you know, people he knew were suffering from HIV or even from AIDS, and saw how, when he learned about something like Truvada, he was shocked to find that it was difficult to access. You had to get onto certain studies to be able to have access to a pill like Truvada and to PrEP. And that a lot of that information wasn't widely circulated in sort of certain the communities that it needed to serve. And he did an amazing thing and started setting up a website, which, you know, people were able to access and see how they could get onto certain studies or certain trials in order to access the pill. And actually, it started off very sort of grassroots, and he was the only one running it. And, you know, he was spending all his time and energy circulating that information. And it eventually got sort of supported and championed by public bodies that direct patients to that information source. And it's really blown up and actually has become a fantastic resource for people. And that's a great sign of how, like, you know,
health outcomes can create actual tangible goals, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I suppose when we look at the benefits of the internet, we can't stay away from support networks for patients.
Yeah.
So in various, especially chronic diseases,
yeah.
Patients might be quite isolated in feeling as though they're the only ones with that disease. And also they might not be able to, let's say, for reasons of, like, safety and health, actually leave their homes to access other people with their conditions to talk about it.
Yeah. So, like, an example of that is cystic fibrosis, yeah. where obviously it affects, like, a really young cohort of people as well.
Yeah, and like all genetic diseases.
Yeah, yeah. And particularly with cystic fibrosis, because they pick up such nasty, like, bugs that really get stuck in the lungs.
Yeah.
Pseudomonas is, like, a big concern with kids that have got cystic fibrosis. And you imagine, like, your young teenagers, like, imagine, you know, you want to be, like, living your best social life, mm-hmm. and actually the people that understand your condition and understand the fact that you're having to pop Creon tablets before, you know,
eating food,
your, like, yeah. you know, your millennial brunch and your avocados,
or that you need
on
to
toast,
like, sit there and, like, cough and hack out your lungs and yeah. go through, like, really rigorous chest physio.
Yeah, like, you kind of want someone that understands that and gets that and experiences that. Yeah. So of course you want to have that, you know, that kind of friendship with people that are similar to you.
Totally.
And the difficulty is that with kids that have cystic fibrosis, is that if some of them have contracted certain illnesses, you don't want them to be passing on those bugs to other people, like to other kids that have got cystic fibrosis, because all their bugs become very drug resistant as well. So it's yeah. really difficult
for them to even be in the same rooms as
yeah.
each other all the time.
But the internet was a great way, like things like YouTube, mm-hmm. it was a great way for these kids to be able to, like, talk about their experiences and develop friendships mm-hmm. with other kids that have got similar conditions and be able to watch their videos and see how, you know, they're living their lives and their experiences. And it was actually a great network, I think, for them. And it's like, if you go on YouTube, you can find like cystic fibrosis vloggers. Mm-hmm. And I think I love that kind of stuff. I think it's so eye-opening.
I love it as well.
You know, we were talking about...
BuzzFeed India.
No. Live for BuzzFeed India. But how important it is just to, you know, get an understanding and appreciation for what your patients are going through.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
And how these conditions affect their day-to-day
lives.
Yeah,
and it's also important to know what the useful resources are to point your patients towards, because essentially you have the opportunity as a specialist to be serving a whole population of patients with the same disease. Now, actually, your interaction with them will be way more vast than their interaction is with each other.
Yeah.
So I think you're actually in the best place to be giving out such support networks. And actually, these specialist nurses are the ones who really know exactly what they're doing.
They do, yeah.
And you know, Super knows that my dad is a sickle cell specialist, actually.
Yeah.
And weirdly, Super met my dad before she met me.
Yeah, I did. I did. And I love your dad and your dad loves me. Like,
yeah,
just
true.
FYI. I did a project with him, like a module with him on sickle cell disease.
As a medical student.
Yeah, I did. And I remember when I met you mm-hmm. and you like mentioned in passing that your dad was a pediatrician. And it was so weird because I was like in passing, and I was just kind of like, this weird thought flitted through my mind. I was like, I know a pediatrician in
sickle cell disease.
Yeah.
A black man.
And I didn't, and I was like, nah. And then I saw your name and we were like signing in during one of the induction things. And I was like, I think that's the point at which I turned to Emily. I was like, I know your dad. And then you mentioned me to your dad and he was like, I know Suba.
Yeah, and then my dad, it's so funny because my dad's like, oh, Suba, I love her personality. She's so, he didn't use this word, but like vivacious. And then he definitely didn't use that word. But he was like, he reminds me of Winnie, who's my little sister. And it's funny because Winnie's like really smart and really intelligent, but she like just doesn't try very hard. And then he was like, and that was Suba. But he said that she was such a natural with like patients and just her interactions were very impressive as a doctor. Basically.
Your dad's
yeah,
so
he
cute.
Really like he really likes you. No, that was funny. That was so
yeah,
funny.
That's so cute. But no, but how important it is for us to be able to direct our patients towards these support networks
totally.
And these communities. Because I mean, as much as you said that we have a more of an interaction with our patients sometimes, the manner of our interaction is very different to an interaction that a patient would have with like a fellow mm-hmm. like a fellow patient who's also going through a similar thing to them.
Yeah, of course. Those are like the friendships that you naturally build up, isn't it? Because you have something in common. And what's actually interesting, when I was in sixth form, I believe, actually no, before GCSE, when I was about 14 or 15, I went to a camp in America with some of my dad's colleagues who work in the States. And I was a camp counselor, and that was like so fun because I was like obsessed by everything American. Now I'm obsessed.
Was
by
this Camp America?
No. I was obsessed by everything American at the time, and now I'm obsessed by everything Japanese. But at the time, it was, I can't remember the name of the charity now. Sorry. But anyway, so I was a camp counselor and it was a camp for children with sickle cell disease.
Yeah.
And they would look forward to this camp every year and absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
And the amazing opportunity was that everything there was served towards these children.
Yeah.
And so, for example, kids with sickle cell disease, if they are exposed to very cold conditions, then that can bring up a crisis. So whenever they went swimming, the swimming pool was like heated up. They would have to like warm up before they went into the water.
Yeah.
And then they were made sure that they were warmed up as soon as they came out of the water. So things that wouldn't even apply for regular children without conditions.
Yeah.
They were well served in that community.
Now,
the other amazing thing was that resources were brought to them and also information was brought to them. So whether it was boys who were suffering with like priapism, basically painful erections, or whether it was girls who were finding it very difficult with their periods, and the bleeding and the pain that they had around their period of time, or just for people who had questions about what their future would look like. Am I going to die at age 40? Am I going to be able to have a baby?
Yeah.
And it's really crazy to like sit in on those conversations as a 15-year-old
and
think, oh my gosh, these 8-year-olds or 12-year-olds are having these conversations about things I've never even considered for myself.
Yeah.
So yes, that was useful for me. But the amazing thing was that this was super useful for them. And they were the lucky people who had access to these camps.
Yeah.
And
to be able to physically travel to this place and be able to come there and live in a country that had that opportunity.
Because that's not the reality for most people with sickle cell disease, for example.
No.
And that wouldn't be the reality for a lot of our kids in the UK who just don't have access to these camps here.
Not at all. But the importance is that they do have places like the internet where, you know, they can find communities or they can find social networks that allow them to have these conversations with other people.
Yeah.
And seek like trustworthy and reliable information sources.
And I suppose the internet has also been very important for us as clinicians, hasn't it? You will always meet people who know way more about the condition that they've always had their entire life and how it affects them. And you sitting behind them on the other side of the table actually may never have heard of the condition before, which happens more often than you realise, or you might just not have enough information that they're seeking.
Yeah. And, you know, the joy is like when you're sitting by a computer, like, in ambulatory care, imagine you have this in day hospital where as they're telling you, you're just like, Google, like, let me quickly just, oh yeah, that thing, right, okay, yeah. I'm with you now, I'm on your wavelength.
Just asking them questions to like delay the time in which they ask you questions. Yeah, and you're like, ooh, thank God.
So what's the weather like out there? Oh, the bus was running on time, that's great.
And it's funny, it's like in day hospital or in GP practice, the computer tends to be in front of you and the patient tends to be on the other side, which is so ideal because you can like quickly type away, figure out some information and be like, oh hey, let me just go print you out this leaflet, then I'll come back and talk to you about the condition. Yeah. And then whilst you're out there, you pick up that leaflet quickly,
you read it real quick. And also that's great, actually, the whole being able to like quickly print someone a leaflet, and also particularly where we work, be able to print someone a leaflet in their own language. Like, that's a beautiful thing. And to be able to bring it back, and you can tell someone something, but they're like, you know, before that sinks in, like they can go home and then sit and read it on the train or try and like process that information or access information later when they get home and they've had time to process a diagnosis or think about their options.
And I suppose that is also very closely linked to the use of like the mobile phones or apps and devices. And with languages in particular, actually it's been very helpful to be able to have a translation app on your phone and discuss with things with patients, simple things, if you don't have access to an interpreter straight away, or you need to bring your device, like your mobile phone, to their bedside because they're too unwell, to come to the main phone to use our hospital translation service. It's been super duper helpful to have the internet access on your phone to use that.
Yeah.
And that's actually interesting because I went to a Google event. I go to so many random events, but I went to a Google event earlier last year.
Yeah.
And they had their pods. And it was the dopest thing I've ever seen. And I was like, this could revolutionise like the NHS.
Wait, explain what that is.
So basically, they've got this translation earbud thing.
Is this a real thing? I thought it was some sort of like, I saw it on Facebook and I was like, is this real?
I saw it in real life. I was like, have just done blown my mind. So there was this girl, they had hired like, I presume like actors or just people who knew like lots
different
of
languages.
And very like, they were very Google. They were all like really... like really engaging and stuff. It was really cool. And this girl, we had this conversation. She was speaking in Japanese, then she flipped to German, and then she flipped to like Spanish. So she just knew a whole host of languages.
That's a pretty nice collection of languages. I wouldn't mind knowing those.
But basically, she was able to speak directly. The information process around the earbuds in some way that I don't even understand. And then her phone would speak to me in English, and it would also show me her translation that was going on in her language, and then my translation, then English in front of that as well. So I could see everything that was happening, processing on the phone while she was talking to me through the earbuds. And the beautiful thing about that was that it allowed us to have a direct conversation with each other, just speaking, rather than like holding the phone, typing, yeah, waiting for the translation to happen, seeing, yeah, if it's correct, because they've just got some amazing technology. So
that's amazing.
Mate, it was amazing. I was thinking, if I had this in the hospital we work in, I would just be speaking to everyone, yeah, very easily.
Yeah, your communication and your like ability to build all the important things in, mm, your like doctor-patient relationship, your trust, your like...
Yeah,
your empathy, all those things you'd be able to have because you're talking with your voice.
And it's just safe to have like proper information coming through in a language that they understand, because,
yeah,
now I'm sure you've worked in pediatric A&E,
mm,
and sometimes if you have patients who don't speak English, where their child is the one who speaks the most English in the family and translates, yeah, for them, when the child is now ill and the parents are the ones who you're trying to gather some more information from, because yes, you can get information from kids, but you can't get a whole appreciation, no, of what went on and what time.
No.
If you ask kids that, you'll just be like on a completely different,
yeah,
plane,
yeah,
or different train of thought.
Yeah.
So you having access to information technology or internet just like that would be so useful in those cases.
Yeah, for, mm-hmm, sure. But even with other apps, so things that patients can use.
Have you advised any apps for patients? Or
so I have... I don't think I've actually ever told patients about specific apps before. Mm. Though I feel like there's sometimes when I've met girls that are like have no idea when their periods are. And I'm like, you know, you can get like period tracker apps. And I'm, mm, like, they're really good because then, you know exactly what your cycle's like. Blah, blah, blah. Whenever people are like, I don't know, it's all over,
yeah,
the place.
You track your symptoms.
You like track it. Yeah, mm-hmm, it's a great idea. But never like said anyone and a specific one by name.
Yeah. Well, I've heard about Headspace, and I feel like we're doing an ad for them because we're on a podcast and like everyone has ads on their podcast shows. But no, Headspace is a really useful app, and it's kind of taken the world by storm in the past year.
Yeah.
Essentially, it's an app for mindfulness, yeah, and it's just been so useful for, I think, our generation, particularly because we're understanding the links between mental health and physical health a lot more.
Yeah.
And actually a lot of the symptoms that play out in the hospital tend to be symptoms that play out at home just, mm, because of the normal stressful lives that we live day to day. So I think apps which might allow you to take time out for yourself, sit down, think, and be more clear in the way that you're going ahead with certain tasks,
yeah,
will be helpful and reduce anxiety or reduce like palpitations. It will, yeah, improve your pain response. Just things that are, that, yeah, we kind of take for granted, but are really, really important in healthcare today.
And I do know that I went to a psychiatry conference once,
okay,
where there was a girl who presented her sort of project that she'd done, where she had used Headspace to guide,
okay,
patients along a mindfulness-based therapy.
Dope.
And it was sort of like 15
was she
minutes.
A doctor? She, was she,
yeah,
a
she was like an F2 doctor at that point, mm-hmm, in her psych rotation or, mm-hmm, something like that. And she'd sort of had a little session, 15 minutes a day. Patients would come in, they'd do a little questionnaire before, do 15 minutes of guided meditation through Headspace,
mm-hmm,
and then at the end fill out a questionnaire.
Dope.
And it showed tangible change in
of
their
course.
Anxiety levels, their mood levels, their sense of peace and calm. So maybe we should start recommending, yeah, it to our patients.
I was like, maybe I should do that today because I'm going to locum in my psych, yeah, hospital today.
Yeah.
That's funny.
So that's a great resource in the hands of patients, because not everyone can afford to go to like find a therapist or find a meditation guide. Yeah.
And it's not easy to go outside of your house when you're not feeling so great,
yeah,
to go and find a psychologist that you can speak to or even access it or afford it.
Exactly. So now,
dum dum dum,
the tone changes. So now talking about maybe the not so great sides of, mm-hmm, having the internet in patients' hands, and I think we have to speak about Dr. Google, right?
Yeah,
like
Dr. Google.
Everyone's,
God bless
enemy.
You've been helpful for me, and for those of us with not so like sharp memories or,
yeah,
who need access to information, you have been so helpful.
You've been there.
But Dr. Google, what are you doing sometimes?
Why are you snaking me, Dr. Google? Like, let's be real right now. But
and it's funny, Dr. Google snakes us in so many ways. Sometimes it gives like patients like so much information that they might not know what to do with. Not even trying to be patronizing, but
no,
just so much random, unreliable, like,
it's overwhelming.
Overwhelming information.
I mean, literally, if you Google any of your like three, like if I were to tell you three feelings I'm feeling right now and I Googled it, Google will definitely tell me I have some type of cancer.
Yeah.
100% it will tell me I've got some type of weird like toenail cancer or something.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And like you could Google your personality and it'll be like, oh my gosh, I've got a personality disorder.
I'm a sociopath.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like I could go through some celebrities and be like, yeah. But let me not do that today. Yeah. Oh gosh. But it's interesting because actually the access to information sometimes isn't given with the access to knowing how to delve into like research or delve into the information that's there.
Or how to critically appraise that information and to be able to be like, well, actually, it's sort of like the classic syndrome of, you know, throughout medical school, there's studies that have shown that each year that goes by, you become more and more paranoid that you have every condition you learn about until you reach a point at which you have enough knowledge to now be able to say, actually, I'm fine.
Yeah.
Like fourth year is that year where you think that you're literally dying and you have everything that you study. And then finally in final year, you're like, it's cool.
It's cool.
It's cool. I'm well.
I don't have myelomas. Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm good. Myeloma.
Yeah, so that's interesting. And it actually ties into public campaigns, I suppose, and also the responsibility of those who are advertising or marketing to give the information across in the right way. So I'm not sure if you remember, but in London last year, probably across the UK, but London because I know it, and the Cancer Research put out a public campaign. So it was these massive posters and you'd see a picture of a large body and underneath it would be like, after smoking, the biggest risk of, the biggest cause of cancer is obesity. So I understand where they were coming from, because with obesity, you're also thinking of poor cardiovascular fitness and you're also thinking about the diets that people are eating.
Yeah.
But what they didn't seem to get was the fact that the image that they have just now popped on all of the like newspapers or on like your tube posters was of a big body without any context or any information to say, actually, you need to be careful of what you're eating. You need to be careful of how much you're smoking. You need to think about your family risk factors.
Yeah.
All they provided was almost an absolute risk of saying, if you're fat or if you're obese, therefore you will get cancer.
Yeah, it was a very sort of one-tone image of like, this equals this.
Yeah.
Without any context behind it, like you said, or understanding of like, what specific risks contribute to, you know, cancer, rather than just saying...
People can gain weight for so many different reasons. And
yeah.
I'm sure there are more things that they're thinking about and more things that they're dealing with than just the weight gain. It's not cancer in most of the cases, actually.
And actually, by also taking it, putting it as an image, it's promoting a certain sort of like mentality. Whereas what they're trying to say is that certain lifestyle modifications equal sort of, you know, a path to health and a path to avoiding sort of the risks like, or things that are, you know, promote risks like cancer. But what it sort of seems to say is like, this certain body type equals this. And if you were to look another way, maybe that wouldn't equal that.
Yeah. And I suppose we also have to look at the communities that we're always discriminating anyway as society.
Yeah.
And the thing is, if we're putting images like that out, we're also perpetuating fat shaming and we're also perpetuating a negative look at how they live their life. And they're really struggling because the society we live in isn't helpful to people who are overweight or have an increased body mass.
It's already a body type that's marginalized. And then to turn around and say, by the way, you got cancer.
Can you imagine some kid in school? It's awful. Like, you got cancer and you're like, what?
This new bullying strategy.
Exactly. Like,
thanks, cancer research.
No. But the message they were trying to send was actually to lead a healthy lifestyle in X, Y, and Z ways, whether it's diet, exercise, you know, certain modifications like stop smoking, blah, blah, blah. But they kind of came across it in a weird way.
Exactly. And it's difficult because actually sometimes we don't appreciate what goes on in the real world with the information that we can access. So, for example, you know, with HIV, just because you started with it, if you look back at the public health campaigns that were put out in the UK years ago, I'm not sure if you ever saw the adverts. It was like this really doom and gloom advert.
No,
and it
I
was
don't.
Like, people are getting AIDS in the UK. And at the time, gay men were very scared about the type of advertising and imagery and the taboo that was put out because of that.
The fear mongering of HIV, though, when actually it's a really, you know, these days, it's a treatable condition. It's a preventable condition. And the fear mongering behind it, people are terrified of getting HIV. And you know how even when we think about needle sticks, you're like, oh my God, am I going to get HIV? You're so much more likely to get Hep B.
Yeah.
Like, HIV is something the least like four, of your concerns.
It's like 400 times more likely to get Hep B.
Literally.
But everyone's like freaking out because of HIV, something that's treatable.
People aren't even that afraid of Hep B. Hep B is a nasty.
Yeah, if you had, like, actually, let me not say that.
Yeah.
That's if I had my pick. No, I'm good.
Don't pick anything. But also, with the internet, this blows my mind. How many people can buy medications? You can straight up get online and buy benzos.
Yeah.
Can you believe that?
I'm laughing, but it's not funny. Actually,
no, and it's dangerous.
It's so dangerous.
It's so dangerous. People are getting hooked on these tablets because they can just get them. It's a controlled drug.
It's a Class C controlled drug, which basically means that you have to have a prescription.
Yeah.
And also...
because it's addictive. Mm-hmm. And not only is it addictive, but you can't just stop taking it. If you've been taking benzos and you just stop taking it...
Your body becomes reliant on it.
You will just start having seizures. Like, you can't just stop it. Like, it's dangerous. Mm-hmm.
But that information isn't put out there by those who are trying to sell it on the internet.
No. And the people that are taking it, like... I mean, I'm hoping that people are self-educating about it, but... It's not a prerequisite.
Yeah. And whilst I think there is a big group of people who are self-educated and understand what the risks and the benefits of these medications are, actually, we also need to regulate these markets efficiently and effectively.
Absolutely.
Because actually, the problem, or I'd say the pitfall with the internet, is that things are moving so fast and the information age is moving so fast. And also, retail and money is a big motivator.
Yeah.
Actually, if their priority is making money, they probably just don't really care very much about...
Shout out capitalism.
They probably just don't care very much on how it's affecting people individually.
No, you
can't. Or how many lives are being lost or affected.
Yeah. I feel like in my mind it's drawn as one of those like newspaper, like, you know, those cartoons of like some fat cat with like lots of dollars and people like...
People behind the door, like, just dying.
Yeah, like, dying people with their hands, like, seeking the diazepam, but with no consideration of the dangers and how that affects them.
Yeah.
But also how that affects your relationship with your patient.
What do you mean?
So your doctor-patient relationship, the paternalistic relationship has really changed. You know, now it's you're on a much more equal footing, which is a great thing. You have patients taking much more... You know, patient autonomy is a huge thing. Patients taking much more interest in their health decisions and it being a collaborative effort rather than you're turning up to your doctor for your doctor to tell you what to do and how to do it. But is that starting to shift more the other way almost? If patients are coming to you saying and telling you what they want you to do for them.
I suppose it's changed for a whole generation because actually if you look at our elderly patients, they're a lot more deferent to us than our younger patients are.
Yeah, which makes me sad sometimes.
And it has its benefits and it has its negatives.
Yeah.
But also, I suppose one thing is that we have to change the way in which we relate to patients now because we are different and we're in a different time. So therefore, it's our responsibility and opportunity to be different clinicians.
Yeah.
I suppose with all the information that's out there, one of our job roles should be to lessen the anxiety for people on that whole host of information that's just been like shoved in their faces.
The ocean of like overwhelming knowledge.
You can like sit in a GP practice, pick up a leaflet and it's going to tell you to have a cervical smear or a bowel cancer screen. And that can really make people more anxious about their health or what symptoms that they might be having.
Yeah.
Because we have to really protect our vulnerable population as well, don't we?
Yeah. And it's about you still kind of holding that like so-called expert status and being able to like you said, manage patients' anxieties. Yeah. And that still remains probably the biggest tool in your arsenal as a doctor.
Totally. And before we finish, just to bring it back to the story that you first gave. So you said that initially that the patient that you met came into contact with a clinician who said that, no, you can't get PEP.
Out of hours.
Just full stop.
Yeah.
Now, if what they meant is that you can't get PEP here or that you can't get PEP today, their responsibility there was to tell the patient how they could access PEP. That's what they should have done.
Yeah, elsewhere.
Exactly. So I think the responsibility in our case should be to inform people more wholly about what they can, or more holistically about what they can access, rather than just saying, no, you can't do it, and not giving the full information behind that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So empowering your patients mm-hmm. and giving them the knowledge that they need to achieve their health outcomes.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Full stop.
Yeah.
That
so
was good.
Yeah, I would say I think the internet is a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. Internet, the age of the internet in medicine and in patients' hands is a fantastic thing.
It is. It is. So, Suba, we got to go.
Yeah, we got things to do.
And we'll probably be using the internet in a myriad of ways today.
Yeah.
Instagram, Facebook.
Not health related issues. Yeah.
Maybe I'll use Headspace, who knows?
Yeah, you should. It's great.
So thank you very much for listening, guys.
Thanks for listening as always, guys. And
do you want to end, Suba? You know what to tell them?
Yeah, so like, share, subscribe, comment. Double tap. You know how we do. And we'll catch you in our next episode.
All right. Take care, guys.
Take care, guys. Bye. Today's episode was recorded at Mare Street Market.
Catch us over on www.afterthelettersmarket.com or /afterthelettersmarket on every social media network.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.